there to die. Valdespino paused. All I can guess is that the strain of the last few days was too much for him. Kurvish considered the possibility, feeling a wave of heartbreak and confusion. He too had been struggling with the implications of Kirsch's discovery, and yet the idea that Allama al-Fadl would kill himself in despair seemed wholly unlikely.
Something is wrong here, Kurvish declared. I don't believe he would do such a thing.
Valdespino fell silent for a long time.
I'm glad you said that, he finally agreed. I have to admit, I too find it quite difficult to accept that this was a suicide.
Then who could be responsible?
Anyone who wanted Edmund Kirsch's discovery to remain a secret,
the bishop replied quickly.
Someone who believed, as we did, that his announcement was still weeks away.
But Kirsch said nobody else knew about the discovery,
Kurvish argued.
Only you, Allama al-Fadl, and myself. Maybe Kirsch lied about that, too. But even if the three of us are the only ones he told, don't forget how desperately our friend Syed al-Fadl wanted to go public. It's possible that the Allama shared information about Kirsch's discovery with a colleague in the Emirates.
And maybe that colleague believed, as I do, that Kirsch's discovery would have dangerous repercussions.
Implying what? The rabbi demanded angrily. That an associate of al-Fadl killed him in order to keep this quiet? That's ridiculous.
Rabbi, the bishop replied calmly, I certainly don't know what happened. I'm only trying to imagine answers, as you are.
Kurvish exhaled.
I'm sorry. I'm still trying to absorb the news of Syed's death.
As am I. And if Syed was murdered for what he knew, then we need to be careful ourselves. It is possible that you and I are also targeted.
Kurvish considered this.
Once the news goes public, we are irrelevant.
True, but it is not yet public.
Your Grace, the announcement is only minutes away. Every station is carrying it.
Yes, Valdespino let out a tired sigh. It seems I'll have to accept that my prayers have gone unanswered.
Kurvish wondered if the bishop had literally prayed for God to intervene and change Kirsch's mind.
Even when this goes public, Valdespino said, we are not safe. I suspect Kirsch will take great pleasure in telling the world that he consulted with religious leaders 3 days ago. I'm now wondering if an appearance of ethical transparency was his true motive for calling the meeting. And if he mentions us by name, well, you and I will become the focus of intense scrutiny and perhaps even criticism from our own flocks who might believe we should have taken action.
I'm sorry, I'm just...
The bishop hesitated, as if he had something more he wanted to say.
What is it?
Kurvish pressed.
We can discuss it later. I'll phone you again after we witness how Kirsch handles his presentation. Until then, please, stay inside. Lock your doors. Speak to nobody. And be safe.
You're worrying me, Antonio.
I don't mean to, Valdespino replied. All we can do is wait and see how the world reacts. This is in God's hands now.
Chapter 17. The breezy meadow inside the Guggenheim Museum had grown quiet after Edmund Kirsch's voice boomed down from the heavens. Hundreds of guests were reclined on blankets, gazing up into a dazzling sky of stars. Robert Langdon lay near the center of the field, caught up in the growing anticipation.
Tonight, let us be children again, Kirsch's voice continued. Let us lie out beneath the stars, with our minds wide open to all possibilities.
Langdon could feel the excitement rippling through the crowd.
Tonight, let us be like the early explorers,
Kirsch declared. Those who left everything behind and set out across vast oceans. Those who first glimpsed a land that had never before been seen. Those who fell to their knees in awestruck realization that the world was far greater than their philosophies had dared imagine. Their long-held beliefs about their world disintegrated in the face of new discovery. This will be our mindset tonight.
Impressive, Langdon mused, curious if Edmund's narration was pre-recorded or whether Kirsch himself was backstage somewhere reading from a script.
My friends, Edmund's voice resounded above them, we have all gathered tonight to hear news of an important discovery. I ask your indulgence in allowing me to set the stage. Tonight, as with all shifts in human philosophy, it is critical we understand the historical context into which a moment like this is born.
Thunder rolled in the distance, right on cue. Langdon could feel the deep bass from the audio speakers rumbling in his gut.
To help us get acclimated tonight, Edmund continued, we are very fortunate to have with us a celebrated scholar, a legend in the world of symbols, codes, history, religion, and art. He is also a dear friend. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Harvard University professor Robert Langdon.
Langdon jolted up onto his elbows as the crowd clapped enthusiastically and the stars overhead dissolved into a wide-angle shot of a large auditorium packed with people. On stage, Langdon paced back and forth in his Harris tweed jacket before a rapt audience. So this is the role that Edmund mentioned, he thought, settling back uneasily into the grass. Early humans, Langdon lectured on screen, had a relationship of wonder with their universe, especially with those phenomena they could not rationally understand. To solve these mysteries, they created a vast pantheon of gods and goddesses to explain anything that was beyond their understanding. Thunder, tides, earthquakes, volcanoes, infertility, plagues, even love. This is surreal, Langdon thought, lying on his back and staring up at himself. For the early Greeks, the ebb and flow of the ocean was attributed to the shifting moods of Poseidon. On the ceiling, the image of Langdon dissolved, but his voice continued to narrate. Images of pounding ocean surf materialized, shaking the entire room. Langdon watched in wonder as the crashing waves morphed into a desolate, wind-whipped tundra of snowdrifts. From somewhere, a cold wind blew across the meadow. The seasonal change to winter, Langdon's voiceover continued, was caused by the planet's sadness at Persephone's annual abduction into the underworld. Now the air grew warm again, and from out of the frozen landscape a mountain rose, climbing higher and higher, its peak erupting with sparks, smoke, and lava. For the Romans, Langdon narrated, volcanoes were believed to be the home of Vulcan, blacksmith to the gods, who worked in a giant forge beneath the mountain, causing flames to spew out of his chimney. Langdon smelled a passing whiff of sulfur and was amazed at how ingeniously Edmund had transformed Langdon's lecture into a multi-sensory experience. The rumbling of the volcano abruptly stopped. In the silence, crickets began chirping again, and a warm, grassy breeze blew across the meadow. The ancients invented countless gods, Langdon's voice explained, to explain not only the mysteries of their planet, but also the mysteries of their own bodies. Overhead, the twinkling constellations of stars reappeared, now superimposed with line drawings of the various gods they represented. Infertility was caused by falling out of favor with the goddess Juno. Love was the result of being targeted by Eros. Epidemics were explained as a punishment sent by Apollo. New constellations now lit up, along with images of new gods. If you've read my books,
Langdon's voice continued, you will have heard me use the term God of the Gaps. That is to say, when the ancients experienced gaps in their understanding of the world around them, they filled those gaps with God. The sky filled now with a massive collage of paintings and statues depicting dozens of ancient deities. Countless gods filled countless gaps, Langdon said, and yet, over the centuries, scientific knowledge increased. A collage of mathematical and technical symbols flooded the sky overhead. As the gaps in our understanding of the natural world gradually disappeared, our pantheon of gods began to shrink. On the ceiling, the image of Poseidon came to the forefront. For example, when we learned that the tides were caused by lunar cycles, Poseidon was no longer necessary, and we banished him as a foolish myth of an unenlightened time. The image of Poseidon evaporated in a puff of smoke. As you know, the same fate befell all the gods, dying off, one by one, as they outlived their relevance to our evolving intellects. Overhead, the images of gods began twinkling out, one by one. Gods of thunder, earthquakes, plagues, and on. As the number of images dwindled, Langdon added, but make no mistake about it, these gods did not go gentle into that good night. It is a messy process for a culture to abandon its deities. Spiritual beliefs are etched deeply on our psyches at a young age by those we love and trust most, our parents, our teachers, our religious leaders. Therefore, any religious shifts occur over generations, and not without great angst and often bloodshed. The sound of clattering swords and shouting now accompanied the gradual disappearance of the gods, whose images winked out one by one. Finally, the image of a single god remained, an iconic wizened face with a flowing white beard. Zeus, Langdon declared, his voice powerful. The god of all gods, the most feared and revered of all the pagan deities, Zeus, more than any other god, resisted his own extinction, mounting a violent battle against the dying of his own light. Precisely as had the earlier gods Zeus had replaced. On the ceiling flashed images of Stonehenge, the Sumerian cuneiform tablets, and the great pyramids of Egypt. Then Zeus's bust returned. Zeus's followers were so resistant to giving up on their god that the conquering faith of Christianity had no choice but to adopt the face of Zeus as the face of their new god. On the ceiling, the bearded bust of Zeus dissolved seamlessly into a fresco of an identical bearded face, that of the Christian god as depicted in Michelangelo's Creation of Adam on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Today, we no longer believe in stories like those about Zeus, a boy raised by a goat and given power by one-eyed creatures called Cyclopes. For us, with the benefit of modern thinking, these tales have all been classified as mythology, quaint fictional stories that give us an entertaining glimpse into our superstitious past. The ceiling now showed a photo of a dusty library shelf where leather-bound tomes on ancient mythology languished in the dark beside books on nature worship, Baal, Inanna, Osiris, and innumerable early theologies. Things are different now, Langdon's deep voice declared. We are the moderns. In the sky, fresh images appeared, crisp and sparkling photographs of space exploration, computer chips, a medical lab, a particle accelerator, soaring jets. We are an intellectually evolved and technologically skilled people. We do not believe in giant blacksmiths working under volcanoes or in gods that control the tides or seasons. We are nothing like our ancient ancestors. Or are we? Langdon whispered inwardly, mouthing along with the playback. Or are we? Langdon intoned overhead. We consider ourselves modern, rational individuals, and yet our species' most widespread religion includes a whole host of magical claims. Humans inexplicably rising from the dead, miraculous virgin births, vengeful gods that send plagues and floods, mystical promises of an afterlife in cloud-swept heavens or fiery hells. As Langdon spoke, the ceiling flashed well-known Christian images of the resurrection, the Virgin Mary, Noah's Ark, the parting of the Red Sea, heaven, and hell. So just for a moment, Langdon said, let us imagine the reaction of humankind's future historians and anthropologists. With the benefit of perspective, will they look back on our religious beliefs and categorize them as the mythologies of an unenlightened time? Will they look at our gods as we look at Zeus? Will they collect our sacred scriptures and banish them to that dusty bookshelf of history? The question hung in the darkness for a long moment. And then abruptly, Edmund Kirsch's voice broke the silence. Yes, Professor, the futurist boomed from on high. I believe all of that will happen. I believe future generations will ask themselves how a technologically advanced species like ours could possibly believe most of what our modern religions teach us. Kirsch's voice grew stronger as a new series of images splashed across the ceiling. Adam and Eve, a woman shrouded in a burqa, a Hindu firewalk. I believe future generations will look at our current traditions, Kirsch declared, and conclude that we lived during an unenlightened time. As evidence, they will point to our beliefs that we were divinely created in a magical garden, or that our omnipotent creator demands that women cover their heads, or that we risk burning our own bodies to honor our gods. More images appeared, a fast-moving montage of photographs depicting religious ceremonies from around the world, from exorcisms and baptisms to body-piercing and animal sacrifices. The slideshow concluded with a deeply unsettling video of an Indian cleric dangling a tiny infant over the edge of a 50-foot tower. Suddenly the cleric let go, and the child plummeted 50 feet straight down into an outstretched blanket which joyful villagers held like a fireman's net. The Grishneshwar temple drop, Langdon thought, recalling that it was believed by some to bring God's favor to a child. Thankfully, the disturbing video came to an end. In total darkness now, Kirsch's voice resonated overhead. How can it be that the modern human mind is capable of precise logical analysis and yet simultaneously permits us to accept religious beliefs that should crumble beneath even the slightest rational scrutiny? Overhead, the brilliant sky of stars returned. As it turns out, Edmund concluded, the answer is quite simple. The stars in the sky grew suddenly brighter and more substantial. Strands of connecting fiber appeared, running between the stars to form a seemingly infinite web of interconnected nodes. Neurons, Langdon realized, just as Edmund began to speak. The human brain, Edmund declared. Why does it believe what it believes? Overhead, several nodes flashed, sending pulses of electricity through the fibers to other neurons. Like an organic computer, Edmund continued, your brain has an operating system, a series of rules that organizes and defines all of the chaotic input that flows in all day long. Language, a catchy tune, a siren, the taste of chocolate. As you can imagine, the stream of incoming information is frenetically diverse and relentless, and your brain must make sense of it all. In fact, it is the very programming of your brain's operating system that defines your perception of reality. Unfortunately, the joke's on us, because whoever wrote the program for the human brain had a twisted sense of humor. In other words, It's not our fault that we believe the crazy things we believe. The synapses overhead sizzled, and familiar images bubbled up from within the brain. Astrological charts, Jesus walking on water, Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard, the Egyptian god Osiris, Hinduism's four-armed elephant god Ganesha, and a marble statue of the Virgin Mary weeping literal tears. And so, as a programmer, I have to ask myself, what kind of bizarre operating system would create such illogical output? If we could look into the human mind and read its operating system, we would find something like this. Four words appeared in giant text overhead. Despise chaos, create order. This is our brain's root program, Edmund said. And therefore, this is exactly how humans are inclined, against chaos and in favor of order. The room trembled suddenly with a cacophony of discordant piano notes, as if a child were banging on a keyboard. Langdon and those around him tensed involuntarily. Edmund yelled over the clamor, "The sound of someone banging randomly on a piano is unbearable. And yet if we take those same notes and arrange them in a better order..." The haphazard din immediately halted, supplanted by the soothing melody of Debussy's Clair de Lune. Langdon felt his muscles relax, and the tension in the room seemed to evaporate. "Our brains rejoice," Edmund said. "Same notes, same instrument, but Debussy creates order. And it is this same rejoicing in the creation of order that prompts humans to assemble jigsaw puzzles or straighten paintings on a wall. Our predisposition to organization is written into our DNA, and so it should come as no surprise to us that the greatest invention the human mind has created is the computer, a machine designed specifically to help us create order out of chaos. In fact, the word in Spanish for computer is ordenador, quite literally, that which creates order. The image of a massive supercomputer appeared, with a young man sitting at its lone terminal. "Just imagine you have a powerful computer with access to all of the information in the world. You are permitted to ask this computer any questions you like. Probability suggests you would eventually ask one of two fundamental questions that have captivated humans since we first became self-aware." The man typed into the terminal, and text appeared. "Where do we come from? Where are we going?" "In other words," Edmund said, "you would ask about our origin and our destiny. And when you ask those questions, this would be the computer's response." The terminal flashed. "Insufficient data for accurate response." "Not very helpful," Kirsch said, "but at least it's honest." Now an image of a human brain appeared. "However, if you ask this little biological computer, where do we come from? Something else happens." From out of the brain flowed a stream of religious images. God reaching out to infuse Adam with life, Prometheus crafting a primordial human out of mud, Brahma creating humans from different parts of his own body, an African god parting the clouds and lowering two humans to earth, a Norse god fashioning a man and a woman out of driftwood. "And now you ask," Edmund said, "where are we going?" More images flowed from the brain, pristine heavens, fiery hells, hieroglyphs of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, stone carvings of astral projections, Greek renderings of the Elysian Fields, Kabbalistic descriptions of Gilgul Neshamot, diagrams of reincarnation from Buddhism and Hinduism, the Theosophical Circles of the Summerland. "For the human brain," Edmund explained, "any answer is better than no answer. We feel enormous discomfort when faced with insufficient data, and so our brains invent the data, offering us, at the very least, the illusion of order. creating myriad philosophies, mythologies, and religions to reassure us that there is indeed an order and structure to the unseen world. As the religious images continued to flow, Edmund spoke with increasing intensity. Where do we come from? Where are we going? These fundamental questions of human existence have always obsessed me, and for years I've dreamed of finding the answers. Edmund paused, his tone turning somber. Tragically, on account of religious dogma, millions of people believe they already know the answers to these big questions. And because not every religion offers the same answers, entire cultures end up warring over whose answers are correct and which version of God's story is the one true story. The screen overhead erupted with images of gunfire and exploding mortar shells. A violent montage of photos depicting religious wars, followed by images of sobbing refugees, displaced families, and civilian corpses. Since the beginning of religious history, our species has been caught in a never-ending crossfire. Atheists, Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, the faithful of all religions. And the only thing that unites us all is our deep longing for peace. The thundering images of war vanished and were replaced by the silent sky of glimmering stars. Just imagine what would happen if we miraculously learned the answers to life's big questions. If we all suddenly glimpsed the same unmistakable proof and realized we had no choice but to open our arms and accept it, together, as a species. The image of a priest appeared on the screen, his eyes closed in prayer. Spiritual inquiry has always been the realm of religion, which encourages us to have blind faith in its teachings, even when they make little logical sense. A collage of images depicting fervent believers now appeared, all with eyes closed, singing, bowing, chanting, praying. But faith, Edmund declared, by its very definition, requires placing your trust in something that is unseeable and indefinable, accepting as fact something for which there exists no empirical evidence. And so, understandably, we all end up placing our faith in different things because there is no universal truth. He paused. However, the images on the ceiling dissolved into a single photograph of a female student, eyes wide open and intense, staring down into a microscope. Science is the antithesis of faith, Kirsch continued. Science, by definition, is the attempt to find physical proof for that which is unknown or not yet defined, and to reject superstition and misperception in favor of observable facts. When science offers an answer, that answer is universal. Humans do not go to war over it. They rally around it. The screen now played historical footage from labs at NASA, CERN, and elsewhere, where scientists of various races all leaped up in shared joy and embraced as new pieces of information were unveiled. My friends, Edmund now whispered, I have made many predictions in my life, and I'm going to make another one tonight. He took a long, slow breath. The age of religion is drawing to a close, he said. And the age of science is dawning. A hush fell over the room. And tonight, mankind is about to make a quantum leap in that direction. The words sent an unexpected chill through Langdon. Whatever this mysterious discovery turned out to be, Edmund was clearly setting the stage for a major showdown between himself and the religions of the world. Chapter 18. ConspiracyNet.com. Edmund Kirsch Update. A Future Without Religion? In a live stream currently reaching an unprecedented 3 million online viewers, Futurist Edmund Kirsch appears poised to announce a scientific discovery that he hints will answer two of humanity's most enduring questions. After an enticing pre-recorded introduction by Harvard professor Robert Langdon, Edmund Kirsch has launched into a hard-hitting critique of religious belief in which he has just made the bold prediction, "The age of religion is drawing to a close." So far tonight, the well-known atheist appears to be a bit more restrained and respectful than usual. For a collection of Kirsch's past anti-religious rants, click here. Chapter 19. Just outside the fabric wall of the domed theater, Admiral Avila moved into position, hidden from view by a maze of scaffolding. By staying low, he had kept his shadow hidden and was now ensconced only inches from the outer skin of the wall near the front of the auditorium. Silently, he reached into his pocket and removed the rosary beads. Timing will be critical. Inching his hands along the string of beads, he found the heavy metal crucifix. Amused that the guards manning the metal detectors downstairs had let this object slip past them without a second glance. Using a razor blade hidden in the stem of the crucifix, Admiral Avila cut a 6-inch vertical slit in the fabric wall. Gently, he parted the opening and peered through into another world, a wooded field where hundreds of guests were reclining on blankets and staring up at the stars. They cannot imagine what is coming. Avila was pleased to see that the two Guardia Real agents had taken up positions on the opposite side of the field, near the right front corner of the auditorium. They stood at rigid attention, nestled discreetly in the shadows of some trees. In the dim light, they would be unable to see Avila until it was too late. Near the guards, the only other person standing was Museum Director Ambra Vidal, who seemed to be shifting uncomfortably as she watched Kirsch's presentation. Contented with his position, Avila closed the slit and refocused his attention on his crucifix. Like most crosses, it had two short arms that made up the transverse bar. On this cross, however, the arms were magnetically attached to the vertical stem and could be removed. Avila grabbed one of the cruciform's arms and forcefully bent it. The piece came off in his hand and a small object fell out. Avila did the same on the other side, leaving the crucifix armless, now just a rectangle of metal on a heavy chain. He slid the beaded chain back into his pocket for safekeeping. "I'll need this shortly." He now focused on the two small objects that had been hidden inside the arms of the cross. 2 short-range bullets. Avila reached behind him, fishing under his belt, pulling from the small of his back the object he had smuggled in beneath his suit jacket. Several years had passed since an American kid named Cody Wilson had designed the Liberator, the first 3D-printed polymer gun, and the technology had improved exponentially. The new ceramic and polymer firearms still did not have much power, but what they lacked in range, they more than made up for by being invisible to metal detectors. "All I need to do is get close." If all went as planned, his current location would be perfect. The regent had somehow gained inside information about the precise layout and sequence of events this evening, and he had made it very clear how Avila's mission should be carried out. The results would be brutal, but having now witnessed Edmund Kirsch's godless preamble, Avila felt confident that his sins here tonight would be forgiven. "Our enemies are waging war," the regent had told him. "We must either kill or be killed." Standing against the far wall in the right front corner of the auditorium, Ambra Vidal hoped she did not look as uncomfortable as she felt. "Edmund told me this was a scientific program." The American futurist had never been shy about his distaste for religion, but Ambra never imagined tonight's presentation would display such hostility. "Edmund refused to let me preview it," There would certainly be fallout with the museum board members, but Umbra's concerns right now were far more personal. A couple of weeks ago, Umbra had confided in a very influential man about her involvement in tonight's event. The man had strongly urged her not to participate. He had warned of the dangers of blindly hosting a presentation without any knowledge of its content, especially when it was produced by the well-known iconoclast Edmund Kirsch. "He practically ordered me to cancel," she remembered, "but his self-righteous tone made me too incensed to listen." Now, as Umbra stood alone beneath the star-filled sky, she wondered if that man was sitting somewhere watching this live stream, his head in his hands. "Of course he is watching," she thought. "The real question is, will he lash out?" Inside Almudena Cathedral, Bishop Valdespino was sitting rigidly at his desk, eyes glued to his laptop. He had no doubt that everyone in the nearby royal palace was also watching this program, especially Prince Julian, the next in line for the throne of Spain. The prince must be ready to explode. Tonight, one of Spain's most respected museums was collaborating with a prominent American atheist to broadcast what religious pundits were already calling a blasphemous anti-Christian publicity stunt. Further fanning the flames of controversy, the museum director hosting tonight's event was one of Spain's newest and most visible celebrities, the spectacularly beautiful Umbra Vidal, a woman who for the past 2 months had dominated Spanish headlines and enjoyed the overnight adoration of an entire country. Incredibly, Ms. Vidal had chosen to put everything at risk by hosting tonight's full-scale attack on God. Prince Julian will have no choice but to comment. His impending role as Spain's sovereign Catholic figurehead would be only a small part of the challenge he would face in dealing with tonight's event. Of substantially greater concern was that, just last month, Prince Julian had made a joyous declaration that launched Umbra Vidal into the national spotlight. He had announced their engagement to be married. Chapter 20. Robert Langdon was feeling uneasy about the direction of this evening's event. Edmund's presentation was skating dangerously close to becoming a public denunciation of faith in general. Langdon wondered if Edmund had somehow forgotten that he was speaking not only to the group of agnostic scientists in this room, but also to the millions of people around the globe who were watching online. Clearly, his presentation was devised to ignite controversy. Langdon was troubled by his own appearance in the program, and although Edmund certainly meant the video as a tribute, Langdon had been an involuntary flashpoint for religious controversy in the past, and he preferred not to repeat the experience. Kirsch, however, had mounted a premeditated audio-visual assault on religion, and Langdon was now starting to rethink his nonchalant dismissal of the voicemail Edmund had received from Bishop Valdespino. Edmund's voice again filled the room, the visuals dissolving overhead into a collage of religious symbols from around the world. "I must admit," Edmund's voice declared, "I've had reservations about tonight's announcement, and particularly about how it might affect people of faith." He paused. "And so 3 days ago, I did something a bit out of character for me. In an effort to show respect to religious viewpoints, and to gauge how my discovery might be received by people of various faiths, I quietly consulted with 3 prominent religious leaders, scholars of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. And I shared with them my discovery." Hushed murmurs echoed throughout the room. As I expected, all 3 men reacted with profound surprise, concern, and, yes, even anger at what I revealed to them. And while their reactions were negative, I want to thank them for graciously meeting with me. I will do them the courtesy of not revealing their names, but I do want to address them directly tonight and thank them for not attempting to interfere with this presentation. He paused. God knows they could have. Langdon listened, amazed at how deftly Edmund was walking a thin line and covering his bases. Edmund's decision to meet with religious leaders suggested an open-mindedness, trust, and impartiality for which the futurist was not generally known. The meeting at Montserrat, Langdon now suspected, had been part research mission and part public relations maneuver. A clever get-out-of-jail-free card, he thought. Historically, Edmund continued, religious fervor has always suppressed scientific progress, and so tonight I implore religious leaders around the world to react with restraint and understanding to what I am about to say. Please, let us not repeat the bloody violence of history. Let us not make the mistakes of our past. The images on the ceiling dissolved into a drawing of an ancient walled city, a perfectly circular metropolis located on the banks of a river that flowed through a desert. Langdon recognized it at once as ancient Baghdad, its unusual circular construction fortified by three concentric walls topped by merlins and embrasures. In the 8th century, Edmund said, the city of Baghdad rose to prominence as the greatest center of learning on earth, welcoming all religions, philosophies, and sciences to its universities and libraries. For 500 years, the outpouring of scientific innovation that flowed from the city was like nothing the world had ever seen, and its influence is still felt today in modern culture. Overhead, the sky of stars reappeared. This time, many of the stars bearing names beside them. Vega, Betelgeuse, Rigel, Aldebar, Deneb, Akrab, Catalpha. Their names are all derived from Arabic, Edmund said. To this day, more than two-thirds of the stars in the sky have names from that language because they were discovered by astronomers in the Arab world. The sky rapidly filled with so many stars with Arabic names that the heavens were nearly blotted out. The names dissolved again, leaving only the expanse of the heavens. And, of course, if we want to count the stars, Roman numerals began appearing one by one beside the brightest stars. IV. The numbers stopped abruptly and disappeared. We don't use Roman numerals, Edmund said. We use Arabic numerals. The numbering now began again, using the Arabic numbering system. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You may also recognize these Islamic inventions, Edmund said, and we all still use their Arabic names. The word algebra floated across the sky, surrounded by a series of multivariable equations. Next came the word algorithm, with a diverse array of formulas. Then azimuth, with a diagram depicting angles on the Earth's horizon. The flow accelerated. Nadir, zenith, alchemy, chemistry, cipher, elixir, alcohol, alkaline, zero. As the familiar Arabic words streamed by, Langdon thought how tragic it was that so many Americans pictured Baghdad simply as one of those many dusty, war-torn Middle Eastern cities in the news, never knowing it was once the very heart of human scientific progress. By the end of the 11th century, Edmund said, the greatest intellectual exploration and discovery on Earth was taking place in and around Baghdad. Then, almost overnight, that changed. A brilliant scholar named Hamid al-Ghazali, now considered one of the most influential Muslims in history, wrote a series of persuasive texts questioning the logic of Plato and Aristotle and declaring mathematics to be the philosophy of the devil. This began a confluence of events that undermined scientific thinking. The study of theology was made compulsory, and eventually the entire Islamic scientific movement collapsed. The scientific words overhead evaporated and were replaced by images of Islamic religious texts. Revelation replaced investigation. And to this day, the Islamic scientific world is still trying to recover. Edmund paused. Of course, the Christian scientific world did not fare any better. Paintings of the astronomers Copernicus, Galileo, and Bruno appeared on the ceiling. The Church's systematic murder, imprisonment, and denunciation of some of history's most brilliant scientific minds delayed human progress by at least a century. Fortunately, today, with our better understanding of the benefits of science, the Church has tempered its attacks. Edmund sighed. Or has it? A globe logo with a crucifix and serpent appeared with the text, Madrid Declaration on Science and Life. Right here in Spain, the World Federation of the Catholic Medical Associations recently declared war on genetic engineering, proclaiming that science lacks soul and therefore should be restrained by the Church. The globe logo now transformed into a different circle, a schematic blueprint for a massive particle accelerator. And this was Texas's superconducting supercollider, slated to be the largest particle collider in the world, with the potential for exploring the very moment of creation. This machine was, ironically, positioned in the heart of America's Bible Belt. The image dissolved into a massive ring-shaped cement structure stretching out across the Texas desert. The facility was only half-built, covered with dust and dirt, apparently abandoned midway through its construction. America's super collider could have enormously advanced humankind's understanding of the universe, but the project was canceled due to cost overruns and political pressure from some startling sources. A news clip showed a young televangelist waving the best-selling book, The God Particle, and angrily shouting, "We should be looking for God inside our hearts, not inside of atoms. Spending billions on this absurd experiment is an embarrassment to the state of Texas and an affront to God." Edmund's voice returned. "These conflicts I've described, those in which religious superstition has trumped reason, are merely skirmishes in an ongoing war." The ceiling blazed suddenly with a collage of violent images from modern society. Picket lines outside genetic research labs, a priest setting himself on fire outside a transhumanism conference, evangelicals shaking their fists and holding up the Book of Genesis, a Jesus fish eating a Darwin fish, angry religious billboards condemning stem cell research, gay rights, and abortion, along with equally angry billboards in response. As Langdon lay in the darkness, he could feel his heart pounding. For a moment, he thought the grass beneath him was trembling, as if a subway were approaching. Then, as the vibrations grew stronger, he realized the earth was indeed shaking. Deep, rolling vibrations shuddered up through the grass beneath his back, and the entire dome trembled with a roar. The roar, Langdon now recognized, was the sound of thundering river rapids being broadcast through subwoofers beneath the turf. He felt a cold, damp mist swirling across his face and body, as if he were lying in the middle of a raging river. "Do you hear that sound?" Edmund called over the booming rapids. "That is the inexorable swelling of the river of scientific knowledge." The water roared even louder now, and the mist felt wet on Langdon's cheeks. "Since man first discovered fire," Edmund shouted, "this river has been gaining power. Every discovery became a tool with which we made new discoveries, each time adding a drop to this river. Today we ride the crest of a tsunami, a deluge that rages forward with unstoppable force." The room trembled more violently still. "Where do we come from?" Edmund yelled. "Where are we going? We have always been destined to find the answers. Our methods of inquiry have been evolving exponentially for millennia." The mist and wind whipped through the room now, and the thundering of the river reached an almost deafening pitch. "Consider this," Edmund declared. It took early humans over 1 million years to progress from discovering fire to inventing the wheel. Then it took only a few 1,000 years to invent the printing press. Then it took only a couple 100 years to build a telescope. In the centuries that followed, in ever-shortening spans, we bounded from the steam engine to gas-powered automobiles to the space shuttle. And then it took only 2 decades for us to start modifying our own DNA. We now measure scientific progress in months, Kirsch shouted, advancing at a mind-boggling pace. It will not take long before today's fastest supercomputer will look like an abacus. Today's most advanced surgical methods will seem barbaric, and today's energy sources will seem as quaint to us as using a candle to light a room. Edmund's voice and the roar of pounding water continued in the thundering darkness. The early Greeks had to look back centuries to study ancient culture, but we need look back only a single generation to find those who lived without the technologies we take for granted today. The timeline of human development is compressing. The space that separates ancient and modern is shrinking to nothing at all. And for this reason, I give you my word that the next few years in human development will be shocking, disruptive, and wholly unimaginable. Without warning, the thundering of the river stopped. The sky of stars returned. So did the warm breeze and the crickets. The guests in the room seemed to exhale in unison. In the abrupt silence, Edmund's voice returned at a whisper. "My friends," he said softly, "I know you are here because I promised you a discovery. And I thank you for indulging me in a bit of preamble. Now let us throw off the shackles of our past thinking. It is time for us to share in the thrill of discovery." With those words, a low, creeping fog rolled in from all sides, and the sky overhead began to glow with a pre-dawn light, faintly illuminating the audience below. Suddenly, a spotlight blazed to life and swung dramatically to the back of the hall. Within moments, nearly all the guests were sitting up, craning backward through the fog in anticipation of seeing their host appear in the flesh. After a few seconds, however, the spotlight swung back to the front of the room. The audience turned with it. There, at the front of the room, smiling in the blaze of the spotlight, stood Edmund Kirsch. His hands were resting confidently on the sides of a podium that seconds ago had not been there. "Good evening, friends," the great showman said amiably as the fog began to lift. Within seconds, people were on their feet, giving their host a wild standing ovation. Langdon joined them, unable to hold back his smile. "Leave it to Edmund to appear in a puff of smoke." So far, tonight's presentation, despite being antagonistic toward religious faith, had been a tour de force, bold and unflinching, like the man himself. Langdon now understood why the world's growing population of free thinkers so idolized Edmund. If nothing else, he speaks his mind in a way few others would dare. When Edmund's face appeared on the screen overhead, Langdon noticed he looked far less pale than before, clearly having been professionally made up. Even so, Langdon could tell his friend was exhausted. The applause continued so loudly that Langdon barely felt the vibration in his breast pocket. Instinctively, he reached in to grab his phone, but suddenly realized it was off. Strangely, the vibration was coming from the other device in his pocket, the bone conduction headset, through which Winston now seemed to be talking very loudly. Lousy timing. Langdon fished the transceiver from his jacket pocket and fumbled it into place on his head. The instant the node touched his jawbone, Winston's accented voice materialized in Langdon's head.
"Professor Langdon? Are you there? The phones are disabled. You're my only contact. Professor Langdon?"
"Yes, Winston. I'm here," Langdon replied over the sound of applause around him.
"Thank goodness,"
Winston said.
Listen carefully. We may have a serious problem.
Chapter 21. As a man who had experienced countless moments of triumph on the world stage, Edmund Kirsch was eternally motivated by achievement, but he seldom felt total contentment. In this instant, however, standing at the podium receiving a wild ovation, Edmund permitted himself the thrilling joy of knowing he was about to change the world. "Sit down, my friends," he willed them. "The best is yet to come." As the fog dissipated, Edmund resisted the urge to glance skyward, where he knew a close-up of his own face was being projected across the ceiling and also to millions of people around the world. "This is a global moment," he thought proudly. "It transcends borders, class, and creeds." Edmund glanced to his left to give a nod of gratitude to Ambra Vidal, who was watching from the corner and had worked tirelessly with him to mount this spectacle. To his surprise, however, Ambra was not looking at him. Instead, she was staring into the crowd, her expression a mask of concern.
"Something's wrong,"
Ambra thought, watching from the wings. In the center of the room, a tall, elegantly dressed man was pushing his way through the crowd, waving his arms and heading in Umbra's direction. That's Robert Langdon, she realized, recognizing the American professor from Kirsch's video. Langdon was approaching fast, and both of Umbra's Guardia agents immediately stepped away from the wall, positioning themselves to intercept him.
What does he want?
Ambra sensed alarm in Langdon's expression. She spun toward Edmund at the podium, wondering if he had noticed this commotion as well, but Edmund Kirsch was not looking at the audience. Eerily, he was staring directly at her.
"Edmund, something's wrong."
In that instant, an ear-splitting crack echoed inside the dome, and Edmund's head jolted backward. Ambra watched in abject horror as a red crater blossomed in Edmund's forehead. His eyes rolled slightly backward, but his hands held firmly to the podium as his entire body went rigid. He teetered for an instant, his face a mask of confusion, and then, like a falling tree, his body tipped to one side and plummeted toward the floor, his blood-spattered head bouncing hard on the artificial turf as he hit the ground. Before Ambra could even comprehend what she had witnessed, she felt herself being tackled to the ground by one of the Guardia agents. Time stood still. Then, pandemonium. Illuminated by the glowing projection of Edmund's bloody corpse, a tidal wave of guests stampeded toward the back of the hall, trying to escape any more gunfire. As chaos broke out around him, Robert Langdon felt riveted in place, paralyzed by shock. Not far away, his friend lay crumpled on his side, still facing the audience, the bullet hole in his forehead gushing red. Cruelly, Edmund's lifeless face was being illuminated in the stark glare of the spotlight on the television camera, which sat unattended on a tripod, apparently still broadcasting a live feed to the domed ceiling and also to the world. As if moving through a dream, Langdon felt himself running to the TV camera and wrenching it skyward, pivoting the lens away from Edmund. Then he turned and looked through the tangle of fleeing guests toward the podium and his fallen friend, knowing for certain that Edmund was gone.
"My God, I tried to alert you, Edmund, but Winston's warning came too late."
Not far from Edmund's body, on the floor, Langdon saw a Guardia agent crouched protectively over Ambra Vidal. Langdon hurried directly toward her, but the agent reacted on instinct, launching himself upward and outward, taking three long strides and driving his body into Langdon's. The guard's shoulder crashed squarely into Langdon's sternum, expelling every bit of air in Langdon's lungs and sending a shockwave of pain through his body as he sailed